This is Fresh Air, and I'm Terry Gross. My guest is singer and songwriter Leonard Cohen. With his songs like Suzanne, Bird on a Wire, So Long Marianne, and Hey, That's No Way to Say Goodbye, he created his own brand of folk rock art music. Listeners discovered Cohn's songs in the mid-60s when Judy Collins recorded Suzanne, and Cohn followed that up by recording his own album of his songs. His moody interpretations quickly won him a devoted following.
Suzanne takes you down to her place near the river. You can hear the boats go by, you can spend the night beside her, and you know that she's half crazy, but that's why you wanna be there. And she feeds you tea and oranges that come all the way from China, and just when you mean to tell her that you have no love to give her, then she gets you her wavelength, and she lets the river answer that you've always been her lover. And you want to travel with her, and you want to travel blind, and you know that she will trust you, for you've touched her perfect body with your mind.
Leonard Cohen isn't a polished singer and doesn't have a remarkable range, but as rock critic Robert Christgau put it, Cohen has a miraculously intimate voice, which has become more expressive and confident over the years without losing its beguiling amateurishness. By the time Cohen started recording, he was already a published poet and novelist, best known for his book Beautiful Losers. Many of Cohen's fans have lost track of him in the last few years. He's 51 now and lives in Montreal, the city he grew up in. He told me he tries to release a book or record every 2 or 3 years. When I spoke with Leonard Cohen, I described his songs as gloomy and despairing. He told me that's not the reaction he gets from most of his fans.
I don't get a lot of mail, but most of the mail I get that treats of that subject has the contrary information. It's like, that song got me through the night, or your songs got me through the night. I certainly know what despair is about, as everybody else does. I prefer the word serious. I think seriousness is a voluptuous kind of enjoyment that we don't find too often.
Which came first for you, poetry or songs? Were you writing poetry before you were actually writing music?
No. My first job was in a country western band when I was about 16 years old in Montreal. And then I got very interested in folk song, in the folk song. And I used to go down to Harvard and listen to all the records in their folk music collection there. And it was through the lyric of folk music that I became interested in a more formal kind of poetry.
I'm trying to imagine your voice singing country and western music. Were you singing?
I wasn't singing. We had a caller. We were mostly doing barn dances and square dances.
Oh. That's an interesting switch from that to the kind of folk music you were doing.
I understand what you mean by that, but it seemed a very natural thing for me to play that kind of music and then to move into music and then to move into what I think is mistakenly called more sophisticated kinds of music. Because a song that can deliver home with 3 or 4 chords is highly sophisticated.
You have a very untheatrical voice. It's in some ways very intentionally flat. I don't mean flat as opposed to sharp, but...
Well, I tend to want to dissolve my personality behind the song. There are some very great practitioners of that style, like Billie Holiday, for instance, who sings just about every song the same way. But that approach can be very effective.
Detachment.
It's a kind of detachment, but it's a kind of emptiness that you can fill somehow. The imagination leaps in to fill, or sometimes even your own heart is invited to fill it with certain kinds of nuance.
How old were you when you started writing folk songs?
Well, I'd written songs all through my teens, but I was 32 when I made my first record. I'd already published two or three books by that time.
Was that with John Hammond, that record?
Yes, John Hammond invited me out for lunch. He'd heard one of my songs. I think he'd heard Judy Collins' version of Suzanne. And he's an extremely generous and hospitable man and has brought everybody from Billie Holiday to Aretha Franklin to Dylan to CBS. He invited me out for lunch, and I went back to my hotel room at the Chelsea where I was staying at the time. He said, "Would you mind playing me a few tunes?" So I played him six or seven tunes, and he said, "You got it." And I was signed to CBS, and he produced the first tracks, but then he became sick. And I started working with John Simon.
Yeah, Judy Collins recorded Suzanne, your song, before you did, and she recorded several other of your songs as well. How did you first hook up with her?
I met her through a mutual friend in New York City, and I sang her a couple of songs, and she seemed quite interested. I was in the middle of writing Suzanne at the time. The songs generally take me quite a long time to write. And when I'd finished it, I called her up from Montreal, and I wedged the phone between my ear and my shoulder, and I played it to her over the phone. And she said, I want to do that right away. She said, "I'm in the studio now." So she transcribed the words, and she recorded it first. Actually, the first person to record it was Noel Harrison, I believe.
Can you tell us how you wrote that song and what was on your mind at the time?
I guess the same things that are on my mind all the time, which are somehow the city, the woman, and the Lord. I usually confuse all those elements in just about every song. When I fell on the guitar pattern, I thought this was a good song, and there's a certain chord change that I think lifts the song. But a friend of mine invited me down to her place near the river and served me constant comment tea, which was tea and oranges. And the song is, curiously enough, a very accurate reportage of exactly the situation. It was by the St. Lawrence River. It has a lot of Montreal in the song. It's not important to know that to have any affection for the song, but it feels like a song that comes out of Montreal.
You said that the Lord, the city, and the woman are frequently confused or equated in your mind. What do you mean by that?
I mean that if you fall in love and the embrace is wide enough, it seems to take in everything.
Do you think that women are more godly than men or anything?
No, but I think that woman is man's content and that man is woman's content. I think that we think about each other a great deal.
Let's get back to Judy Collins, who you had a few minutes ago told us you had sung Suzanne to on the telephone. How did it make you feel when she had such a lot of success with that recording? Did it make you want to record yourself too? And did you want your recording to be better or more successful? Did that bother you?
No, I had no sense of competition with Judy Collins, who's a singer I admire very much. And I was mostly what I felt was gratitude. It was the first time a song of mine had been recorded that people knew about. And also Judy is very, very helpful person, not just to me, but to many people. And she introduced me to people, and she gave me an opportunity to sing at some of her concerts. I was delighted that she recorded, and I still think it's the one of the finest versions of the song that I've ever heard.
Folk music or art music or whatever you'd want to call the kind of amalgam that a lot of people were performing and that your writing kind of falls into was really very, very popular at that period in the 60s and the early 70s. And New York seemed to be one of the centers for people who were writing or performing that kind of music. Did you move to New York at that time?
Well, no. I had been in Greece for a few years where I'd written a few books and songs, too. I published a novel called Beautiful Losers that was very gorgeously reviewed across the country, but it didn't sell any copies until much later when it came out in pocketbook. And I was having a hard time making a living. So I thought that I'd go down to Nashville and either become a picker down there or try to sing songs. In hindsight, it seems like the height of folly to try to resolve your economic problems by becoming a country western singer. But I loved the music very much. And I'd been listening to the Armed Forces radio station coming out of Athens, and where they had a large part of it was country music. So I thought I'd go down to Tennessee. I hadn't heard of this folk music renaissance that was taking place in New York at the time. I'd been out of touch. And I came to New York on my way to Nashville when I found, you know, all these great singers there. And then I did stay there for a while.
Did you want to become a part of any of the scenes that were going on then?
I never really became a part of any scene. I'm not sure anybody ever really does. I'm not sure. I'm not even sure whether there is such a scene. There was a certain sense of community among a certain number of singers. I wasn't part of it, but they were hospitable and seemed to recognize me, at least professionally, as a peer.
Did you have any regard then for what kind of image you're going to present to your listeners, especially when you started recording and touring?
I'd never given it much thought. You know, there were a group of us in Montreal who started out together, friends. We had high plans for ourselves as writers and artists and singers, sculptors. I'm speaking about the age of 13 and 14. And we had this mad notion that we were all famous at 13 and 14, and that whenever we met, you know, just to have a drink, it was a summit event. And also, I went up through what you might call the Montreal School of Poetry. Montreal has produced a lot of the poets in Canada, and there's a certain intensity to that work that is recognized as forming vaguely a school. It doesn't have much of a meaning, but just for the purpose of the conversation. What it really was a group of very serious writers who had connected in one way or another, and we'd get together often and read our work to each other, and it would be submitted to the most vicious kind of criticism.
By the press? Or?
No, by
each
other.
Oh, by each other.
By each other.
Right.
These were very informal. The press had no
right,
interest in
right.
us. We couldn't sell a book of poems. The average book of poems in those days sold a couple of hundred copies and usually put them out yourself. So there were no prizes or rewards for any of this. This was just a devotion to a certain mad idea of what craft and expression was. So after you'd gone through this kind of training for a number of years, we never saw it as training, but people would cry after one of these sessions. You had to defend every word. And it tended to turn you into quite a serious a worker in that realm. So having come out of that through my late teens and first years of university, I already had a sense of myself as someone who was serious about the thing. And that sense of it has persisted. You know, the notion of how well you've measured up to the standards you set for yourself when you were reading Shakespeare's sonnets at the age of 16, that's another question that goes up and down.
My guest is songwriter, singer, poet, and novelist Leonard Cohen. There's a lot of religious imagery in your songs, and some of it is really Christian imagery. I know that you're Jewish by birth. Were you exposed to a lot of Christian ritual or language or imagery in your youth that made you absorbed in it?
Well, my father was very sick when I was a kid, and we had a nanny to take care of us who was an Irish Catholic woman. Her name was Ann Smith, and we called her Nursie. And I went to church often with her, and used to spend Easter and Christmas at her family house in Montreal. So I did see, I did feel the warmth of a Christian celebration. And I was impressed by the richness of the Catholic churches and the liturgy. I was touched by that. I also had a conservative and quite strict Jewish upbringing.
Were it Orthodox? Or?
It was conservative, I would say right-wing conservative.
Really? How did you break out of the right-wing conservative upbringing? It seems to me that you did.
I feel that somehow my family were very compassionate about it. I was given the information, and I suppose I absorbed the attitudes, but they were not fanatical people. And my mother was Russian and a very warm, open-hearted kind of woman. My father, too, was a very decent man. And it was never presented to me oppressively. And, you know, even when I made that mad decision in my teens to, you know, live in the bohemian section of town, whatever it was at that town, you know, I wasn't annihilated by my family for those kind of decisions. My mother's father was a writer, so that somehow there was a liberal strain in the whole training.
And it was possible for them to believe that an adult could be a writer,
yes,
and self-respecting and make a living.
Yes,
make a living
never very certain to them, but self-respect, that they understood.
So your parents were very religious in conservative Judaism. Were you ever religious? Are you religious? And
I have a great respect for religious practice, and I go in and out of practicing. You know, so I'm a very bad example of an observant Jew. I think there are 613 commandments that Maimonides identified, and the story is told of the man approaching the rabbi saying, "I can't follow 613." He said, "You know, we'll do 600 or 500 or 400." You know, so I have two or three that I try to observe.
Which are those?
Well, those are really private matters.
Right, that's fine.
I
yeah.
Can't go into that.
I want to ask you about the album that you did, which Phil Spector produced, and how that came to be, and what you thought of it. I should just mention, realizing that not all of our listeners will know who he is, that he was like one of the really best producers of rock and roll records in, I guess, the early '60s. Had you known his work well from?
I grew up with it.
Did you?
Yeah, and I had hoped that I would find him in his Debussy phase, which was to know him as to love him. But I found him in a kind of post-Wagnerian stage. But he came to a concert that I gave in Los Angeles and invited me back to his house. And he locked the doors, so I couldn't leave. And he kept his air conditioning very low. It was about 37, I think. It's very cold. And I suggested that since I can't leave, and there's bodyguards all over the place too, so you don't really want to argue with the man. But he's very hospitable and a very charming man. And we started writing that night.
Since you couldn't leave, you decided you should play some music together?
Yeah, exactly. And we wrote well together, and we had the same style of writing. That is, we'd work all night if we had to finish something. And after a month or so, we'd written.
Did you not leave for a month?
Oh, no,
locked in for a month.
He eventually let me go.
Uh-huh.
He's an eccentric man, but as I say, very, very warm and very brilliant and very funny, very witty, eccentric. We finished the songs, and then when we moved into the studio, he seemed to change hats rather dramatically. And I think his model was a Borgia prince. There were a lot of armed men around the studio. And
what for? What do you think he was afraid would happen?
I think he just likes to command a military unit. He likes to command. And in a certain sense, he's a great mad commander. And he's gotten some startling things out of musicians by this kind of mad czarist style that he's developed. I found it a little disconcerting. One time he came over to me with a bottle of Manischewitz in one hand and a 45 in the other, and put his arm around my shoulder and dug the muzzle of the 45 into my neck and cocked it and said, I love you, Leonard. And I hoped that he did at that moment. But I was very fond of Phil. I don't think you hang out with a man like that unless in a certain way you fall in love with him. There was something very engaging about the man. I didn't like the record when it came out because he confiscated the tapes under armed guard and mixed it in secret. I couldn't find out where he was doing it. So I had the option of hiring my own private army and fighting it out with them on Sunset Boulevard or letting it go. I'd spent so much time and energy making it, I couldn't think of not putting the record out.
Did you try to disavow it when it came out?
I just told everybody I hated it. But I'm feeling a lot more tender about it now. And I think the songs are good. I always thought the songs were good. And I think it has a certain kind of life, a certain kind of anxiety and vitality that is pretty good.
Did you ever think he was really going to kill you when he came in with the gun?
No, I did think he loved me.
And what was the gun doing there? I guess I could ask what the Manischewitz was doing there, too.
Boys like to play with guns.
Uh-huh.
I like them myself, but, you know, he pulled a gun on the fiddle player, who was a boy from the South who knew a lot about guns. He was a man, actually, and a big man, and he was playing the fiddle in a tune called Fingerprints. And Phil said, I don't like the way you're playing that, and he pulled out his gun. And this musician just stood up and walked out of the studio. Never saw him again.
What do you like to do with guns? Do you hunt?
No, I don't hunt. I like target practice.
Do you do that in your home? Do you live out in the country?
Well, I kind of fell into it because I was interested in becoming a cowboy at one time.
Becoming a cowboy? as in the Western movie way?
Well, when I lived in Nashville, I had a lot of admiration for these guys that I saw around. They were very attractive. I liked the way they spoke, and I liked a certain sense of honor that these men had, and a lot of them carried guns or had rifles in the back of their trucks. That's when I started getting interested in firearms.
Do you own any now?
Well, they were taken away from me.
By who?
My lawyer locked up my Valtor PPK automatic. And I think my rifles are locked up in somebody's closet. And I haven't used anything for a long time.
Do you think your lawyer had a good reason for locking them away?
Well, I didn't have a license in the state where I happened to be. So he didn't think it was a good idea for me to carry it around. I never carried it around, but I had it in my possession. I have some pellet guns now, and my children and I set up a target range in my house in Montreal. And we do target practice with that.
Yeah, a lot of parents are really afraid that their kids are going to play with guns. That doesn't bother you?
I'm of course, everything bothers me about the children. You know, one is in a continual state of anxiety after you have children. But, you know, I'd rather supervise that kind of activity and control it and teach the kids the correct handling of a weapon, even though it's only a pellet pistol. But, you know, I don't even like to talk about it. You know, I have an Eastern European mother who used to spit whenever a child's beauty was praised or the possibility of danger was articulated. So let's not continue on with this.
You're living in Montreal now after having spent several years living in New York. Why did you choose to return to Montreal, which is where you grew up?
I never left Montreal. I always kept my little place there. And even when I was living in Greece, I would come back to Montreal. And you could live in Greece for $1,000 a year in those days when I was starting out as a writer. I had the option of teaching in university or doing some other kind of work. since I wanted to write full-time, I would come back to Canada and do various kinds of jobs, journalism or running an elevator or whatever it was that could put together that $1,000 or $800, and I'd go back to Greece and live for a year. But I kept coming back to Montreal.
Do you still perform your early songs in concert?
Yes. We do songs from the very first record to this one.
Do you have any favorites of your repertoire?
I think they move in and out of favor, like children. I think someone observed that sometimes you prefer one to another. Sometimes a song will stick in your throat and you don't even want to sing it. Somehow you can't get behind it any longer.
What about a song like Bird on the Wire?
I start every concert that I've ever given with Bird on the Wire. I don't know why that song somehow... I can approach the people in the audience with that song and somehow indicate why I'm there.
Can you tell us about writing it?
I guess I began it in Greece, with the most pedestrian observation of seeing a bird on the telephone wires outside my window. I'll give you the first verse. It goes, the first three lines go, like a bird on the wire, like a drunk in a midnight choir, I've tried in my way to be free. In Greece, the men walk home through the streets of this village where I was, and they kind of stumble home after a hard night of drinking, singing the most immaculate three-part harmonies as they made their way home. And nobody ever comes to the window and says, keep quiet or go home. And on a Saturday night, you'll hear a lot of singing in the village, and even if you're asleep, you'll wake up for a moment, but you don't mind waking up to that kind of noise. So that midnight choir has always touched me. And then I think I went back to Montreal, and some of the, then came the long work of carpentry, which every song involves, changing it around and trying to make it into a song.
My guest has been singer, songwriter, and poet Leonard Cohen.